Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill, and this Wishy, I can tell by your outfit today, you're ready for this show.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. We're going to titillate the listeners.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a really great show because it's WNG Day.
World Naked Gardening Day, which is actually the same. It was Derby Day, but close enough. Yes. The whole weekend we're celebrating.
I think it goes perfectly with Derby Weekend.
It does.
It does indeed. I bet you we could see a little WNGD in the infield on Derby Day.
It's been known to happen.
With some of the tulips and such.
And huh? Down the stretch, they strip.
Okay. All right. Okay. I am fully clothed, however.
Yes, she is.
But I do have to say that And I'm changing my ways just because of our other guest who's going to talk to us about the damaging effects of the sun. Typically out in the country when I'm alone working in the middle of the summer,
yeah.
I don't have a whole lot on. I mean, I'm clothed and such and, you know, appropriate to a certain degree, but I don't have a whole lot on. But I'm learning to wear really lightweight, long sleeve, old, you know, button up shirts of Andes, that sort of thing, to cover up more, really, just because of the sun exposure. But we'll get to that a little bit later. But yes, today on the show, in honor of World Naked Gardening Day, which was yesterday, we're delighted to have Mark's story on the show, Nude and Natural in the Garden.
He's an interesting guy. We came across him online. He's got a terrific background in naked and nude stuff. But his wife runs the Japanese garden in Seattle.
Which she doesn't do naked.
No. Very interesting life, too. And, and we'll get beyond the giggle factor here sometime, because they're pretty serious about this stuff.
Sure.
And I've, way back in my youth, I experienced some of this, and I also have written stories about nudist camps, and they are pretty serious about it.
Yeah. There's reasons. It's not, like, perverted or whatever, so.
It's not. And sex, believe me, a pile full of naked people,
is
sex
not
is the last thing
titillating
on your mind.
Yeah.
The last thing on your mind.
Unless you have, like, a perfect body, which most of us don't.
Exactly.
All right. And the only downside to gardening in the nude would have to be excessive sun exposure. So what are the effects of the sun on our skin, nude or not? Dr. Tammy Cassis is a practicing dermatologist here in Louisville, and she's going to join us a little bit later to talk about that. Bob and I have both had little bouts of skin damage
and
skin cancer
and
such.
Yeah, it was precancerous removed from the top of my head, and I do wear a very large hat.
And I've had a basal cell carcinoma removed from my upper lip as well, so all sun-related.
But you still talk pretty darn well.
Oh, well, thanks. Scar's not too bad.
No.
My husband still thinks I'm pretty.
He's right.
Yeah, well, thank you. All right, what's going on in your garden, Bob?
Again, spring just showed up all at once, and I knew it was going to happen, but this past weekend, I was sitting under my four crabapple trees as the petals fluttered down on my head, just inhaling the fragrance, looking around at the red buds in bloom and the things coming on. And
it's
even
gorgeous out.
My perennial beds are defining themselves now. They sit there, and there's this black, wet, underwater dirt part of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're starting to pop up. You know, the irises are coming up, and the dahlias are coming up, and all the perennial, the different...
Everything.
Yeah, it's all coming up, and it's like a little city is starting to rise out there, and I just walk around and just take it all in, and that's why we garden.
That is why we garden. And Andy had made a comment, too, about how he was so glad to see everything, you know, so vibrant and so beautiful, because last year we totally got cheated 100%. Nothing
did.
Bloomed. I mean, those prairie fires, those crab apples, and you know my love-hate relationship with them.
Right.
I love them now. They're gorgeous in full bloom. It's just magical. It is gorgeous.
Yeah, I have some prairie fire next to huge white ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I get pictures, and you stand back and take pictures of one against the other,
and
the setting sun or the rising sun. Man.
Pretty nice,
it
huh?
It is cool.
I am trying to acclimate my summer vegetable seedlings to the outdoors.
Uh-oh.
And getting them ready to be planted.
You give them counseling?
Because, you know, I started quite a few things from seed.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I'm not very good at it. They get, like, all scraggly looking.
Leggy.
So then I thinned them, and that actually made quite a difference.
Okay.
And then finally, they grew enough and rooted out enough for everybody to get bumped up to their own pot.
All right.
Then that really made a difference, and then they sort of got their bulkiness, you know, back to quite a few different tomato varieties, heirloom tomato varieties and such. But you can't just take all that stuff from inside to outside in one foul swoop.
No.
I'll put them in the sun for like an hour, and then I move them underneath the umbrella of the table. And then a couple days later, they get a little bit longer in the sun. I mean, otherwise you just burn them up. Yeah. And people this time of the year, they take their houseplants out, stick them out in the sun just like that. And then we get all these calls about, why is my houseplant all burned up?
Yeah.
Because there was no acclimation.
Well, you get that sneaky late frost and the annuals.
But I think we're pretty done with that.
Yeah.
We're done with that. Spring is here, and we're looking.
We're sprung.
We're looking good.
Spring is here, and we're sprung.
Yes, and other things are looking good for the calendar in the area. One of the spring staples after Derby, you always can look forward to the Locust Grove Gardeners Fair at Historic Locust Grove.
Yep.
It takes place this year May 9th, 10th, and 11th, and it's every day from 10 to 5, so check that out.
The good people.
It is great people.
And one of my favorite towns in the area, Madison, Indiana, Madison and Bloom. Madison's great.
Another staple spring event.
Yep, every day of the year, but Madison and Bloom is pretty special. It's May 10th and 11th, and the next weekend, May 17th and 18th. All those wonderful old houses to tour. Six of them will be open to the public. Hours 10 to 4 Saturday, 12 to 4 on Sundays. Mm-hmm. Just contact visitmadison.org. Or go to our website.
Yep, for more information. And Art in the Arbor takes place May 10th and May 11th, starting at 10 a.m. And Art in the Arbor has been going on for a while as well. It takes place at the Thomas Jefferson Unitarian Church, which is 4936 Brownsboro Road.
And easily one of the area's most interesting gardeners, a man named Brian Williams.
Oh, yes.
He breeds tropical plants. Mm-hmm. He's got hardy bananas, elephant ears, cannas, all sorts of weird houseplants and fun houseplants. He'll be at the Louisville Beautification League at 10:15 on May 8th at Historic Nunley House. I've been there. It's a neat house. Brian,
right there in Hurstbourne.
Brian's a complete living anomaly, and it's just fun to listen to, and he really knows his stuff.
Yeah. All right, and out at Blackacre, which is in the J-Town area, there's going to be a presentation on native ornamental grasses. So if you want to get rid of all that fescue in your yard and turn it into something a little cooler and more manageable, this might be the right class for you. It's going to be at 1 p.m. on May 11th out at Blackacre. And again, visit our website at wfpl.org for more information on everything.
And two more things. On Saturday, May 10th, one, Maggie Oster will be at UDEL giving a container herb workshop from 10 a.m. to noon. The Louisville Iris Society will hold its 54th annual Iris Show Saturday, May 10th at St. Mark's Episcopal Church.
So there's no lack of
six things.
Gardening things to do the week after Derby. Everybody saves everything for the week after Derby. For more information, of course, if you missed anything, just check out our website at wfpl.org. And you won't want to miss this. You can't hide anything when you're gardening in the nude, Bob.
Nope. We've got the guy who can tell us all about it. He's Mark Story. He's a college professor in Seattle. He's a member of the editorial staff of Nude and Natural magazine, author of Cinema en Natural, A History of the Nudist Film, and co-author of the book The World's Best Nude Beaches and Resorts.
You need to work on your French there. Au naturel.
Naturel. Well, that's effective.
Effective. It is
French.
Effective.
That's
all right.
That's redundant anyway. He's going to talk about gardening naked and the whole genre of gardening in the nude and how it began and how we can enjoy it and how it can be part of it.
Naturism.
Mark, welcome to Homegrown.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin with a little bit of the history, maybe, about the history of formal and informal nudity as you know around the cultures of the world. How far does this go back? In terms of people hanging around with no clothes on?
Well, it's probably not super, super common. You're going to find nudity in ancient Greece in some contexts, particularly sports, military training and whatnot. You'll find nudity certainly in places in the South Sea Islands, various primal cultures. Once so-called civilization kind of takes root, it looks like we start putting clothes on. And some of the romantics, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and some others, have thought that maybe a little bit of nudity might not be such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of organized social nudity, it's really going to get started in Germany and during the Weimar Republic, somewhere around the 1910s, maybe a little bit earlier, but really starts taking hold as a cultural fad in Germany and then quickly in France in the 1920s.
Huh.
And gets over to England, and this is, it takes a number of shapes. There's the health fad, where it's part of the no alcohol, no tobacco, vegetarianism, lots of exercise, be naked in the sun, and we're going to make ourselves a healthy group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Germany just got beat to heck out of World War One.
Right.
Poverty is a huge issue. A lot of people don't have much money to take any vacations, and people are getting actually quite sick. So as a health movement, it was part of something that was really doing the Germans a lot of good. The mm-hmm. same thing with the French. Within about 10 years, it gets over into the United States in the early 1930s, very early 30s. And the United States just kind of liked the recreational aspect of it. The no alcohol, no tobacco, exercise like crazy kind of faded. And in the United States
the
turned into,
stuck.
Hey, sit out in the sun. This is an inexpensive vacation. You can take the whole family out here, and it's healthy. Of course, they would chant that mantra like crazy. But basically, it was an inexpensive, pleasant way to get out in the sun.
Let me back you up one second.
Sure.
I should have asked this earlier. The Olympics are coming up here, and as I understand it, the original Olympics were in the nude. Is that correct?
Well, the original Olympics weren't, but, and there's different stories in the ancient Greek tradition. The one that seems to be favored by most scholars is some guy is running, he's doing a sprint, gets his little loincloth or whatever he's wearing, falls off, and he ends up winning the race. And all the guys are thinking, wow, if I run naked, maybe I'll win, and then everybody wants to be nude.
Sort of like having that really fancy swimsuit
that they're talking
about.
Don't even talk about that. I don't like that stuff.
Way too much coverage, yeah. I think.
Better than steroids.
Yeah. And that's one of the stories, of course, about the Olympics. The other main one is there was a female who, and the females were not allowed to go to the Olympics. They weren't allowed to observe them on pain of death, but there was a coach who coached this male athlete to victory. Turns out she was female. Her robe fell off. Everybody saw she was female. So one of the stories is that the nudity was demanded to make sure no women would be anywhere near the Olympic athletes.
I've heard that one before.
And there's no really real way of knowing which of these is actually the case. But, yeah, for a long time, nudity was de rigueur in the Olympics. But it was normal for any of the gymnasiums. The word gymnasium means place of naked training. So that was perfectly standard stuff for the athletes to train naked.
So, Mark, can we explore a little bit, what's your take on the cultural attitude, contemporary cultural attitudes about nudity and nakedness? And, you know, Americans have always been so much more uptight about these sorts of things than France and Germany, for example. You've mentioned them in sort of the historical onset of nude beaches and such. But how's culture reflected in nakedness?
Well, it's a big question, but it's a fun one. I travel and write about this kind of thing, so it's certainly an area of interest. You talk about Germany and France, you know, just quickly. Germany today, East Germany, what was East Germany, tended to have a lot of nude beaches. The communist Germans didn't mind. Now that we have East Germany open up and we have West Germans and particularly American tourists showing up, they're griping about the naked people. So the East German are now having to dress up on some of their beaches. France is a whole other issue. France has figured out that people don't have a right not to be offended. What they've done is they've established clothing optional beaches throughout the country, and they're very supportive, the government supportive of private clothing optional parks, resorts. But there's a big clear line in France. It's okay to be naked in an established clothing optional zone, a resort, a club, a park, or a beach. But you just, no way you're going to be walking around the streets naked. But France has figured out it's okay. It's huge impact. I mean, the official French tourist bureau publishes brochures and magazines on the clothing optional beaches in France, and they just bring in scads of money because there's no problem. United States is something different. We have a tougher time with nudity unless it has to do with sex or violence. It seems like, you know, you have violence and sex on the movies, it's okay. But my God, if someone is simply skinny dipping, people's eyes, people's heads are going to blow up. I have an artist friend. He's a Chinese artist in Portland, Oregon, and he does paintings of nudes in non-sexualized settings, eating, walking in the woods, playing volleyball, or whatever people might be doing, gardening even. And he has a hard time bringing those paintings into art galleries. And he says all the gallery owners tell him the same thing. People will understand erotica, people will understand figure studies, but they don't understand why anybody would be naked in a normal, non-sexualized setting. And he has the hardest time selling the things because of it. It's an odd thing.
Let's kind of move forward into the World Naked Gardening Day, which coincides with our Derby Day, so it's perfect. Where'd that come from?
Well, 2005, my wife, my friend Daniel Johnson, and his friend, we were just kind of sitting around the table. We had been involved in what's known as World Naked Bike Ride, and this was something that my friend and some people up in Canada established. Cities around the world, people get on bicycles and ride to make a claim about oil consumption. A lot of folks just were not interested in the political issue, and we're thinking to ourselves, we understand that having a non-sexualized setting, where you're just going to be with some friends, be with some family, and do whatever you would do, whether it's, you know, hiking or barbecuing or whatever, naked, seems to be a very healthy, profitable thing. How could we encourage people to give it a try? So we're asking, well, what would people do? They don't want to be political. A lot of them don't want to be on bicycles. They certainly don't want to be running around bicycles naked downtown.
Right.
Swimming, we thought. Everybody likes swimming. But then we thought, there's a lot of people nowhere near swimming. What's the second most popular thing people like to do naked?
And gardening.
Every survey I've run across, wow. I run across a bunch on this,
yeah.
Every survey indicates that gardening is the second most popular thing for people to do naked. It's family friendly.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, let's have World Naked Gardening Day. And we really had a very specific goal with this. We didn't want to own it. We didn't want to control it. We both, you know, all of us belong to various naturist groups and whatnot. We didn't want it to be associated with any particular group. We wanted to kind of set it free on the Internet and get it out into some various magazines and whatnot, just kind of see if people would understand the goofiness, the funniness, mm-hmm. the freedom involved in trying gardening naked once. And we figured if people could tie those two things together, at a very human level, they would find, one, it's a nice thing to garden, it's good for the earth, it's good for us to relate to the earth, but it's also, we can find, it's good to relate to ourselves, to kind mm-hmm. of break away from the alienation we have from ourselves with other people. And it just surprised me how much it's taken off without any input from us whatsoever since then.
So would I qualify if I just did it topless?
You'd be halfway there.
Okay. Baby steps.
What we had in mind was we defined gardening in terms of just potting plants indoors in your own Manhattan apartment,
yeah.
if that's where you happen to be. And it could be by yourself. But I think trying it actually fully naked, there's a last bit of cloth that seems to really do a lot to us. It just kind of
frees you up.
We're very attached to that last bit of cloth. So we're mm-hmm. thinking gardening. You can do it inside by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it in your private backyard with mm-hmm. family, with friends, if you need to rake leaves, plant tomatoes or whatnot. We define it as cleaning trails up in the mountains. I'm in the Seattle area, so we've got a lot of wilderness area nearby. And some groups will get out there and just do a trail clearing area.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go out and find some isolated trail. We like kind of pushing, you know, my friends, my wife, and I like kind of pushing the envelope a little bit. So we'll find a city park that we scout it out ahead of time, make sure we're picking a time of the day when
yeah.
there's going to be minimal people there and it's not likely to run across and bother anybody. Find like a mess, some weeded area or whatnot,
and
just do a stealth naked gardening run. And in half an hour, we just run around, clean stuff up. Every now and then we see somebody and they're looking at us like they're doing a good thing. Maybe I should hold off calling the cops until we finish cleaning up that mess. And we've never actually had a problem. Just had a great deal of fun.
Sounds like Seattle. You've mentioned a couple times family friendly. And there are people, I think especially in America, think of the whole family naked together has got some really bad connotations they don't want to think about.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Can you explain that feeling and what it's like really?
Well, I don't have kids, so you know, kids aren't really, you know, a huge part of my life. I'm 49, but just don't have them.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends do, and some of them, the kids are part of their, you know, part of all their lives. The kids are part of a family life.
Sure.
I think it's kind of sad that some people, when they associate, when they think of nudity and kids, the first thing they think of is bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think of skinny dipping in bathtubs. Other folks, there's some bad people out there, and any naturist group worth their salt is going to do darn what they can, whatever they can do, to you know, keep those folks out. And the church has problems with that. Boy Scouts do. It's kind of everywhere. And we should be vigilant and make sure that kids are protected. But no kid's head is ever blown up by seeing their mom naked. It's an odd thing. We tend to get worried about that. You weren't going this way, I know. We tend to get worried about this kind of thing with white folk. But you look at some other cultures, and it's like nobody even thinks that a kid's going to have a problem growing up seeing his Nigerian parents naked from time to time,
mm-hmm.
or his Samoan parents naked from time to time.
Right.
It's an odd little thing. But no, I don't think that mere nudity is going to have any effect on kids. In fact, every sociological and psychological study that's clinical, that's had any good academic testing,
mm-hmm.
looked at this, shows there's been no negative effect whatsoever on kids in non-sexualized situations. In fact, it seems to have some benefit, at least to boys, according to UCLA psych professor Paul Okami.
So it might be a good way to get your kids involved in gardening on World
Naked
Gardening Day, too.
Well, there's that, too. The kids' angle really hasn't been anything we've been focusing on. When I envision World Naked Gardening Day, I'm envisioning, I don't know, maybe a middle-aged lady who just is maybe not fully comfortable with her body. Maybe
uh-huh.
she thinks she's a little too much of this, a little too much of that.
Yeah.
In her own house, by herself, getting naked, and try potting a plant. I bet in the 15 minutes it takes for her to pot that plant, she'll have a different feeling about who she is and her worth.
Yeah.
And I think part of our human nature is to work with the natural world, and actually working with the dirt, working with the plants, growing something, tending something, caring for it, and having it, the fruit, you know, come, whether it's right. a pretty plant or a pretty flower or actual fruit to eat, I think that helps us to actually flourish and thrive as human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think the same kind of thing can happen with a more respect and self-satisfaction with our own bodies and with the humanity of others.
Indeed. Mark, how many years have you been doing this?
The World Naked Gardening Day? Since 2005.
Since 2005. Have you been able to monitor in any way people that have actually gotten involved in you know, as you say, you know, maybe potting up a plant naked for a half an hour, or going out in the backyard and tending to some stuff?
There are some projects where I'll actually try to do that, but this one I've really specifically and consciously tried not to. Mm-hmm. We have kind of this listserv, which is pretty loose. People can sign up and they can share ideas and whatnot. All I know is some of the countries people are coming from, and I just have to take them at their word for it, that they're mm-hmm. saying, you know, I'm from India, I've heard about this, or from Spain or Portugal or whatnot. It seems to be pretty much an international thing now. And that just may be one person in India and two people in Spain. I don't know. But it seems to be international. The idea was twofold. Get naked and do some gardening, however it's comfortable for you, and then tell somebody about it. They don't need to tell me. If they want to go on this, you know, World Naked Gardening Day's listserv, they can do that. I'd rather see people tell their gardening clubs, put in a club newsletter, or tell their friends, or write a letter to the newspaper, whatnot. There's no one group that owns this or controls it, so it's not like anybody's going to benefit financially from it.
Right.
And I would love if people said, wow, this is the goofiest thing in the world, but I got to tell you, I tried this, and here's my experience.
Bob and I had mentioned, we're quite certain that somebody in the infield derby day yesterday probably got naked anyway, so
yeah, well.
Why not do it for World Naked Gardening Day?
Yeah, and I've read about nude house cleaning, nude vacuum cleaning,
sure.
Where housewives do that kind of thing, and I'm sure men do the same thing, too.
So. Well, I just kind of like the idea of the naturalness and of gardening and how I really, there's this book I read, a guy named Cooper, The Philosophy of Gardens, and he takes this Aristotelian slant on seeing what kind of person we are, what our human nature is, and then what kind of activities we can engage in to develop certain kinds of human virtues or human excellences. Mm-hmm. And he makes the case that gardening is one good way of actually becoming a full, flourishing human being. I love that idea.
Yeah.
And I agreed with it. I thought the whole idea of nurturing and working with something in the non-human world for your own good and for the benefit of the garden, the benefit of the ecology as a whole, really resonated. And it seemed to be parallel with my thoughts about family-friendly, non-sexualized nudity.
Right. Well, you've got a private backyard where you garden in the nude. Can you articulate the difference, how it feels to be out there in the nude gardening?
Well, it's just, at the basic surface level, it's certainly pleasant. I mean, I enjoy the wind and the sun. Think about it this way. Would you rather garden on a sunny day with a nice breeze, that perfect day, would you rather garden with a long sleeve, heavy shirt, long pants, and a hat, or, you know, health concerns aside for a second, would you be more comfortable in shorts and a T-shirt? Most people would kind of like that less clothing. It just feels nicer.
Yeah.
Well, long clothes to shorts or shorts to nudity. The ratio goes pretty well. It just feels...
just keeps
it's
getting
free,
better.
It's pleasant. Huh.
Now, what about the problem, say, with the sun or mosquitoes and that kind of thing?
Well, I don't have mosquitoes where I live here. Yeah. In the sun, I just make sure I don't overdo it. I just, you know, just use kind of common sense. We don't have a lot of sun in Seattle, so when it's out there,
yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
But if I was in Arizona, I have a friend who gardens nude constantly in Arizona. He just avoids the heat of the day, mm-hmm. takes advantage of the best times, and put on some clothes and a hat if it gets too sunny.
There you go. Or some extra sunscreen on your
bum. There's no reason to be ridiculous about it.
Right. Well, I think I might give it a shot.
Hey, I think you might find it kind of fun. Just make sure you tell somebody about it.
I'll tell my husband. I'll see if he'll do it with me.
Okay.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mark Story is co-founder of World Naked Gardening Day, now in its fourth year. For more information on Mark or World Naked Gardening Day, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Dr. Tammy Cassis joins us for the latest on the sun, our skin, and how to best protect yourself during a day of gardening, nude or not. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Take it on. Baby, can take it all off. I want you the way you came into the world. I don't want to feel no clothes. I don't want to see no panties. And take off that brassiere, my dear. Everybody's gone. We take the receiver off the phone. Because baby, you and me, this night, we're gonna get it on. To love, serenade.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill. We were about to address a subject near and dear to my head.
Yeah, and like my whole body, apparently.
Yeah, right.
So I think I do want to try the nude gardening thing once at least. But I've
got YouTube on alert about
it. But
this,
I think so. For me, I'm just in trouble with my overly exposed skin.
Well, just nude garden in the barn.
Oh, okay, on the veranda of the barn, or yeah. Just make sure it's like in shading the
sure.
weed or the woodland garden.
And
in the shade.
Warn the neighbors, too.
Okay, well, my neighbors are far enough away. I should
okay.
be all right. but yeah, we are going to talk about some pretty serious issues we'd mentioned earlier in the show that both Bob and I have had some bouts with skin cancer types of things that are sun-related. So for a very long time now, we've wanted to address the topic to warn others that like to garden and be outside a lot that there are some serious concerns, what to look for, what to do to try to prevent. I mean, gosh, if nothing else, the aging effect that the sun has should deter some of our vainest gardeners.
Sure. I should only be 19, but the sun has got me 65 somehow.
Oh, is that what it is?
I don't understand.
But yes, very serious topic, and Dr. Tammy Cassis is coming to the studio to talk to us about it today. She's a graduate of the University of Louisville School of Medicine and a board-certified dermatologist at Cassis Dermatology and Aesthetic Center in Prospect. Dr. Cassis, thank you for coming in, and welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you. Yep. Glad to be here.
Great. Certainly very serious topic, the effects of sun on the skin. Well documented, you know, if you've got some common sense about you, you know that it can have an impact in terms of wrinkles and aging and all of that. But, you know, really, what is going on when our skin is exposed to the sun or overly exposed to the sun?
It is well documented. I think as dermatologists, we're trying to do our best to get the information out there. I think prevention is one of the best things that we can do. Mm-hmm. Just first and foremost, May is Melanoma Skin Cancer Awareness.
Okay.
And actually May 5th is Melanoma Monday.
Okay.
And the whole campaign is see a spot, check a spot, save a life.
Mm-hmm.
And so back to your question, ultraviolet is being given off by the sun. There is UVA, UVB, and UVC.
So three different types of
ultraviolet. Three different types
okay.
of ultraviolet. UVA and UVB actually penetrate into our atmosphere. UVC doesn't penetrate as well, which
okay.
is a good thing. So UVA and UVB will penetrate into our skin and work at the cellular level to cause DNA damage to mm-hmm. our skin. And then over time, a cumulative risk factor will eventually wear our skin down and potentially cause precancerous lesions or then non-melanoma skin cancer such as a basal or mm-hmm. a squamous cell and then possibly a melanoma.
Okay. So are those essentially all the different types of skin cancers that are related to sun exposure?
Those are the three most common types okay. of skin cancers that are related to sun exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Precancerous lesions called an actinic keratosis. Those are the most common type, most commonly on the head and necks of patients. The rough, crusty spot that just won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
Have the potential to turn into a squamous cell carcinoma, which is actually the second most common type of skin cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Basal cell skin cancer is the most common type of skin cancer.
And that's what I have, yeah.
Classically on the yeah. head, neck, chest, yeah. Clinically looking at it, it's the little shiny pearly papule or the white papule that pops up. Patients often think that it's a little pimple that just won't go away, and then it potentially can start to bleed. And so that needs to be just kind of the red flag, you know, something's going on. This is not what it should be. So then back to the squamous cell, again, more kind of the rough, crusty head, neck, ears, lips, tops of hands. And then the third most common, thankfully, is melanoma, because it is the deadliest of the skin cancers. And that is classically or historically the brown spot that starts to change, get larger, get darker. Those are the kind of basic buzzwords to think in your mind. So when I talk to my patients, I encourage them to do their skin examinations, and they want to be looking for the new spot popping up, the spot that's itching, bleeding, burning, getting larger, getting darker.
And melanoma has a reputation for being a rather deadly type of cancer.
Yes.
And is it because it acts aggressively, or is it because it goes undiagnosed for too long? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, well, kind of twofold. Awareness is out there, so I think more people are getting diagnosed earlier. So actually there has been a rise in melanoma, but I hope in my mind that's because awareness is out there and people are getting checked, and it's kind of been brought to the forefront.
A rise in the incidence of it, but not necessarily the mortality.
Correct. But it's deadly because it spreads. If it's left undetected and it isn't caught early, then it can spread through your lymphatic system to your other organs, and then it's deadly.
Okay. Well, Doctor, going back tens of thousands of years, when humans were first starting walking around, there were no clothes. There was skin and a lot of sun. What's the difference between now and then, or is there any difference?
Atmosphere. So the ultraviolet is more intense, and it's getting in, and so, you know, the dreaded ozone.
So the whole global warming thing is also a factor in the
absolutely
in what's going on here.
Absolutely.
And also, when I was a teenager, I went to Galveston, Texas, on the beach many times, and got totally parboiled two or three times. Lobster red, just awful.
Not good.
No, but is a residual effect? Does that ever heal, or is that prone to pop up again sometime 40 years later?
The blister itself?
No, just the residual effect of that kind of skin damage.
Yeah, absolutely. So skin cancer and sun damage is a cumulative effect. So we know, these are a little wide numbers, but 50 to 85% of our sun damage to our skin is done before the age of 18. And so I think that's why the whole push of get your kids protected, be smart, because we know that it's a cumulative risk factor. So you quote unquote, killed your skin when you were young, and now you're paying the price.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the flip side is that when my patients will say, well, then who cares now? I might as well go out and go wild and crazy. Not true. Right. So you want to be smart.
Are you literally burning your skin? Is that what's going on?
Yes.
Back to you.
Yes, you are literally burning your skin in the most complete way.
And just to note, Tammy's a very attractive woman with absolutely fabulously beautiful skin.
Thank you.
And Bob and I are over here all
never tell me that.
Aged and, sun damaged. And, I mean, we're laughing about it, but it is a really serious situation. But so many of us don't care until it's too late.
Correct.
And the damage is done.
Correct.
So we're trying to get to some of you out there who haven't done the damage.
Well, yeah, I drive by the suntan studios. Mm-hmm. People going in there worrying and getting cooked. It just scares the hell out of me.
Do these sun tanning beds
deliver
the same?
More ultraviolet UVA, but yes, it is avoid tanning beds at all costs. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably going to get somebody mad at me, but it's not a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Right. It's terrible.
So can we talk about some of the issues when it comes to sunscreen? And I know I remember several years ago, there was some controversy about sunscreen. You had alluded earlier that there are still some issues. Can we talk a little bit about that? And then tell us what the best recommendation is for good coverage.
It was a hot topic. It still is kind of a hot topic because of public awareness. And the FDA is actually taking this under control because there weren't a whole lot of studies about what was the best, what is the best, how the sunscreens work, waterproof labeling. You need to make a product that's easy for people to understand, but also understand, don't give false pretenses that it's waterproof. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
So we are much smarter about our sunscreens now. And you'll see, hopefully, over the next 6 months that there will be labels out there that make it very easy for people to understand that the FDA is sort of spearheading and that the American Academy of Dermatology is also going in hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So key things for sunscreen. SPF, sun protection factor, 15 to 30 or higher. We know that this is what you need at least on your skin to protect it. The kicker with this is that when they did the studies to look at the, and this is very technical, but the minimal erythema dose that, to protect yourself from the sun, patients were liberal about putting their sunscreen on. And so there's no way that you or I are going to do that. There's, you know, you're chasing yourself, you're chasing your kids, you're chasing your husband out the door, spraying the sunscreen on or rubbing it on. You're not doing as well of a job as what they did in the studies.
Right.
So when you think of that, an SPF 30 with not liberal application is probably closer to an SPF 10 to 15.
Okay.
So I encourage patients 15 to 30 or higher. The higher, the better, in my opinion. That's one factor of sunscreen. Second factor of sunscreen is what is the active ingredient in the sunscreen. And there, at this point, when you look at a bottle, it should say broad spectrum UVA and UVB blocker. Way back, I think that it was sort of nobody knew which one was causing the most damage to the sun. And so, you know, maybe a little bit of misscience or nobody understood correctly. But we know that UVA and UVB both have a role in skin cancer. So you want a broad spectrum. Sunscreens are broken into physical blockers and chemical blockers. Physical blockers are sunscreens that have either titanium or zinc. Those are minerals that are physically going to block the sun out.
Because you're covered in white stuff.
Correct, correct. They've gotten better. Now they're micronized, so it's not so okay. bad. But yes, correct. So the typical, lifeguard with the white
right.
nose. And then the chemical blockers, those chemicals are either avobenzone, or the other name for that is Parsol 1789. Mexoral is a very hot one that's out, that's been in Europe for a while, just recently got FDA approved. And then Helioplex is the new one. Helioplex is stable, basically stable avobenzone. So when you go out into the sun, it's not losing its effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell my patients are, you pick whichever you like, SPF 15 to 30 or higher. Make sure it has one of the highest ingredients in either avobenzone, Parsol 79 is the other name for it, titanium, zinc, Mexoral, or Helioplex. And you can feel confident that you're doing a good job.
And how long does it last?
Well, here's the thing. 30 minutes before you go outside, you need to get your sunscreen on so it has time to absorb into your skin.
That,
you
got
to do it. You just have to.
Okay, then you're outside, you're jogging, you're sweating, you're moving plants around. You have to reapply every hour?
Absolutely. Every hour to 2 hours, depending upon how hot and sweaty you are, you got to do
just
it.
It's like I put it on once and that was it.
Yeah, forget it. And you have to do it. And, you know, I'm very kind of blunt with my patients. I'm like, if you can brush your teeth and you can wear your seatbelt, you can do this.
Yeah, sure.
Human beings come in many different kinds of skin colors, you know, very light color, dark color. Are dark people less susceptible, more susceptible, the same as like the Danes from skin damage?
Here's a simple way to think about that. I'm very fair complected. We have Fitzpatrick is the name of the way that we kind of dissect different skin types. And so a very fair complected, light hair, light eyed would be someone that, you know, only burns. Janine, you're more of a Fitzpatrick type 1 or 2. Very dark complected would be Fitzpatrick type 5 or type 6. So back, 20 or 30 years ago, they looked at what sun protection factor, melanin is what the pigment that we have in our skin that actually protects us from the sun.
Mm-hmm. So the more melanin you have,
the more protection you have.
Okay.
But a Fitzpatrick type 5 or 6 only has a equivocal SPF of about 13. So not enough.
But just a little bit more than as a 1 or 2 would be
maybe
naturally have.
You and I probably have, the three of us probably have maybe 3 or 4.
Oh, okay.
So not enough.
In terms of protection, yeah. Other types of ways that we can protect ourselves from the sun as gardeners, we're going to be outside inevitably. Clothing, are there certain types of cloth that the sun can penetrate through? What are the guidelines in terms of clothing and hats?
Hats, you definitely want to protect the ears. Men especially get skin cancers on the tops of their ears, squamous cell carcinoma. So wide brim hat, the old fisherman's hat, the golfer's hat. You want to hold it up to the sunlight and see if the sunlight penetrates through. If it does, it's not good.
Well, is there any good to the sun and the skin and the human body?
There is. There is a very important role of ultraviolet with vitamin D. This is very well documented. We know this. There is the pre-hormone that is in our skin, a vitamin D, and UVB penetrates the skin and converts it into the skin, where it's then transformed in the kidneys and the liver to active forms of vitamin D, which is essential for strong bones. Vitamin D is very, very much the hot topic right now because we think that there are some correlations between potential prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, hypertension, diabetes, even multiple sclerosis when people have deficiencies in vitamin D. So it's a very much a hot topic because as a dermatologist, I want you to be smart about the sun, but I also don't want you to get something else.
So how much is a good amount of sun for the average person to maintain good, you know, vitamin D absorption and all of that?
You can get vitamin D through your diet. And you can get...
Can you get it at all from the sun?
You can, yeah, you will. You'll get it from the sun. So you going outside for, you know, 5 minutes walking around with your sunscreen on, you're still going to get vitamin D. So I don't think that you need to run out and get fried.
Because I know there was a study done at one point, too, that actually being in the sun, and maybe it was like, maybe it was vitamin D or something, but it set it for certain people that it set off like endorphins or something and that it like literally made people feel better because the sun made endorphins.
Well, I get sad in the winter, SAD.
Yeah.
I need the sun.
That's very well documented.
Yeah.
I absolutely get that.
I think I've lived at that as well. I mean, it does. Yeah. It's like getting out and working and that it's...
And that's the controversy with the tanning beds is that you set off your endorphins, you feel better. People want to feel
cheap therapy.
Yeah, they want to feel better, and which is wonderful. I don't think any dermatologist doesn't want their patients to feel well, but at the same time, just
damage.
Be smart. I mean, just wear your sunscreen, wear your hats, and feel good about it. Just you got to do it.
Yes, doctor. I am really trying, but as we've learned today, I think many of us have done things wrong, even when we think for doing them
Just leave
your copay on the counter here.
Thank you so very much. We appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thank you.
Dr. Tammy Cassis is a board-certified dermatologist at Cassis Dermatology and Aesthetic Center in Prospect and a graduate of the University of Louisville School of Medicine, where she is also an assistant clinical professor for the Department of Dermatology. She's presented and written about melanoma and the effects of aging on the skin, among other dermatological issues. Of course, for more information on Dr. Cassis and the effects of the sun on our skin, please visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With two good questions.
Two good questions.
I'll let me answer one and you answer one.
Okay.
It's a whole new
Will
program.
Will you?
Yeah, I know. I'll let.
That sounds grand.
I normally give you both of them, but this time I'll take one.
I know. Well, one's got your name written all over it, I think, because it has to do with cannas. How about this? Hello, Bob and Janine. Last fall, I dug up canna bulbs and stored them in the garage in a cardboard box with newspaper over them. How can I tell if they'll be okay for planting this spring? I'm fearful that I may have killed them. Love your show. Thanks very much, Diane.
Actually, cannas will tell you.
Yeah.
They put up little white pointer things that say, I'm ready to...
That would be sprout?
Yeah. Well, I'm being you're too technical for me. They put up white pointer things that tell you, please put me outside in some dirt.
Yeah.
I'm ready to go here. And that's really it.
If so would they have done it by now?
Yeah, mine do it in the dark.
Okay.
If it's soft and mushy or if it's just dry and brittle looking, you're not going to do it. But by and large, they're pretty tough.
Yeah, if she kept them in an unheated garage, they should be okay, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
It wouldn't get that cold.
No.
Yeah.
So that should be fine. Look for the white pointy things and go with it.
And by now, she can go ahead and plant them in the ground anyway, right?
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Yeah, I think you'll be fine because it'll be a while until they get above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be okay.
Yeah, and we're into May now, so we should be pretty safe.
Yeah. Question for Miss Wishy, a familiar pest. What can you do to prevent sack worms? I think she means 10 caterpillars, but I like the word sack worms. From nesting in the tree, the white silky tarp forms on the trunk and trails to other areas of the trees. That's kind of poetic.
Mm-hmm.
After a bit of time goes by, there's this greenish, furry, worm, caterpillar-like insects that fall from the tree and land on everybody.
Everywhere.
Any suggestions?
Yes. This is where just like paying attention and clearly she's paid attention because she knows the whole little process. Michelle, just take, this is what I do. I take plastic grocery bag, put my hand in it, and when you, in the morning, before they leave the protection of their little tent, the tent caterpillars, they go out during the day and they feed on the foliage of the plant when they get a little bit older. But when they're still in the tent in the morning, you just grab the tent with the caterpillars inside and all, with the bag that's over your hand.
Yeah.
You grab it and then you pull the bag around and then you smash them. And you
what
throw
about
them in
the 30-foot tent caterpillars way up the crotch?
Then you're just... then you just are out of luck. Right?
Actually, sometimes I'll get a stick and break the bag.
Right.
And then
they fall on your head.
Well, but at least you're doing something.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you can reach them, just pull them out and smash them and do it in the morning or when they're actually in the tent as opposed to when they're not in the tent.
Gotcha.
And do it early.
And often.
And often.
Yeah.
All right.
If you have a squishy or non-squishy question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246.
What is the plant story this week?
The weed from hell.
What?
Henbit.
Henbit?
Yeah.
I just had an epiphany about henbit not too long ago.
So did your chickens.
I know. We finally realized it's called a henbit and chickweed because that's what the chickens like to eat the best.
They do. Huh. Go back for a long time.
So you're
going
to tell me, I'm sure, some additional information about what this means.
It's also called the purple peril, the purple plague, and the prolific progenitor.
Really?
No, I just made those up. But it's the weed that's out there right now.
Yeah.
It's kind of pretty.
It is pretty.
And from a distance in somebody else's yard, it's pretty. It's this purple weed. There's about 50 tons to the average home.
Pretty scalloped foliage.
Yeah, and it's actually an annual, and we'll talk about that later. It reseeds itself, but you can't miss it if you're not sure. It's got square stems, gets 6 inches to a foot tall. The upper leaves kind of encircle the stem, and there's these two-lipped tubular flowers, and they're purple. Mm-hmm. And sometimes pink.
Mm-hmm.
It's Latin. Its full Latin name is Lamium amplicaulii.
Huh.
And Lamium, of course, is Greek for mint. Because it's in the mint family.
In the mint family.
And the amplicaulii is because it's ample. There's a lot of it, yeah.
Wow.
And the general belief is, as you know, it got its name henbit because
hens,
the hens
like
love it.
It.
They eat it like crazy.
This is funny. Did you come up with this just because it was everywhere because I love my chickens? Because
I spent half last week getting henbit out of my yard.
But really, we just had that epiphany, and it's just kind of serendipitous.
It also led to henpecked, which is the kind of husband I am, of course.
Right.
I got so tough.
You need it.
Now, to give Lamiums their due, there are some nice Lamiums and Lamiastrums we use for perennials, like Herman's Pride, a yellow one, and Anne Greenaway has beautiful chartreuse and silver foliage. So the Lamium itself isn't all bad. The henbit's a native of Asia and Europe. It's actually a winter annual, a very prolific cedar.
Cool season weed.
Yeah, it really is. Mm-hmm. And the several sources I looked at said the best way to control it is to, like, a pre-emergent in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Get it before the seeds get started in the fall, and that's the best way to deal with it, because, boy, in the spring, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And it comes with a poem.
Good.
Even we who so suffer waiting spring dread one part of that annual fling. The appearance of the ubiquitous henbit, the purple plague from which we can't get. Far away from, as hard as we try, yet with flowers it can please the eye. A violet fuzz to inspire the bard, if it grows well in someone else's yard. On square stems that hold up the flowers, as we weed it for hours upon hours. Yet even after completing such deeds, left behind are 40 billion seeds. The henbit.
The henbit.
The purple peril.
And out at the farm, my hens are indeed enjoying.
They're bidding it. They're bidding it left and right.
The henbit.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Sarah Frischner and the farm markets of Metro Louisville.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.